Okay, so does anybody have any questions they want to ask at this time? This is not forever hold your peace, but are there any questions regarding resentment inventory and the approach to that or anything that you want to address now? Yeah.
So I know that you shared a sponsor with someone that came up with a different way to do an inventory, and I was wondering if you had any experience with that form of inventory with the Theater of the Y and what your thoughts were on it.
The question was, do I have any experience with the Theater of the Lie? And the answer is no, I don't. I'm not, like, opposed to it. It's just I had everything addressed so far within what I was doing otherwise. And I guess I should make it clear that Don was never my sponsor. I asked him at one time, and he said, well, he asked me the question that I've asked any number of people, what do you believe that you'd get from me being your sponsor that you don't get from me being your friend? And I said, oh, well, I'd be accountable. And he said, in that case, I absolutely will not do it. He said, you need to be accountable. And at that time, Linda was in my life. He says, you need to be accountable to her and to God. You know, I don't have any desire to play cop in your life. And I can't believe that it'd improve our relationship. So what Don really was, is as much as anything else, was like a big brother to me. That's all right. Well, that said, Leslie's going to move us. She's going to plunge into fear here. So.
Plunge into fear. I didn't realize I had a fear inventory. There was one on the back here, and I haven't read this in a while. But what fear is, I mean, if you've done any resentment inventory, a lot of what you find in that last column is I do what I do. I blurt out lies out of fear. I mean, so many of the messes I need to clean up have started with that seed of fear. You know, and I guess it's just, again, I forget who I am. I think I'm independent. I think I exist all by myself. And when I do, I don't have any. I mean, I know what resources I have. And using all my resources, marshaling my will, doing everything I can to just drink like Carol, you know, or to just be as good a cook as Martin, you know, I can't seem to get it done. I can't seem to get it done. You know, there is something I want to say. As I was telling you earlier about a little walk I had out here, and I didn't actually finish that story. I kind of stopped, and which I tend to do all the time. I lose my train of thought constantly, but I miss a little synchronicity part. So, you know, I was telling you about, you know, Mechtilde of Medburg, who wanted to be God's physician. You know, let me take care of you the way you take care of me. And as I was finishing that meditation, I looked up. There was this little on this little area. There's a it looked like a Sacred Heart Jesus. You know, and I thought, oh. And then I looked, and it's well, it doesn't quite look like a Sacred Heart Jesus. There's the heart, but then there's another heart, and then it said Saint. I Googled it, Saint. So I thought, who on earth is that guy? And it's not a guy. Turns out it's a girl, Saint Lutgreg. And I was reading about, you know, her claim to fame. She's also one of these mystics, and what she had asked God, her little turn toward God was asking God, what do you want, God? God is asking her, what do you want? What do you want? I can give you anything. What do you want? She wanted to have a good singing voice, but realized that wasn't it. And she says, I want your heart. And God says, well, you can have it. Can I have yours? You know, this asking permission. And so there's this heart, the Sacred Heart of Jesus coming, and they're exchanging hearts. And I thought, what are the chances I'd be thinking about this random, you know, Mechtilde Medburg in this story that I'd read long ago, and then looking up and seeing that, and it's, that's been happening to me the entire weekend, that I just little conversations that I have with people that just weave in and out in this beautiful tapestry of my life. And so anyway, So you know what? I think I'll just, I don't have any profound, there's no profound thought coming to me about fear. So I think I'll just read this and see what comes up. Other than, I'll tell you what I have discovered is that all my fears end in death. You know, they're always, and it's usually not physical death. Sometimes it is. You know, I'm going to be homeless and living out on the street, you know, because I lost my job and it's going to end up here and I'll be stabbed by a homeless guy on the street. But usually it's, I just spontaneously combust out of embarrassment that you'll see who I am, that I'm not really that smart, or I'm really, I don't pay attention, or I'll just, you'll look at me and I'll just wither away and die. You know, I'll be too embarrassed to live. So they all end in death, and that's a nice thing to know. I don't think I knew that when I was writing this. I don't even remember writing this, but it must have been about 10 years ago because it's on the same sheet of paper. So this fear, so I did it like this, a fear, and then I write the little fear down, and why did I have it, right? And how did I set the ball rolling, you know, as self-reliance failed me? And is there a better way? So I'm just now really kind of reading this. I sort of looked it over. So my fear apparently is not getting my way. And why? Well, why is that? If I don't get my... And I set up a lot of these as a conditional, you know, if then. So if I don't get my way, then I'm a chump. What was wrong with that, being a chump? Well, you know, if I'm a chump, no one respects me. And, well, what's wrong with that? If no one respects me, then I don't respect myself. And if I'm a chump, other people will control my life. And if other people control my life, why even get up in the morning? I'm supposed to have some kind of independence and autonomy, right? So how did I set the ball rolling? Self-reliance failed me. I suffer from the illusion that getting my way is a good thing, a path to happiness. I have overwhelming evidence to the contrary, which is true. I have numerous, you know, inventories that evidence to the contrary, but part of me still worships and has faith in the efficacy of my own mind, which is, you know, remember that part in We Agnostics where it talks about, you know, we had been worshipers, right? We worshiped our own minds, you know, my own ability to get through life. So we have experience with worshiping. And so is there a better way? I have heard, and I have my own experiences with surrender to God's will and to the next right thing, that wanting my own way should be a crazy desire, one that keeps me from true, yet to be seen happiness, right? I'd be crazy to make a plan, execute the plan, and never invite a higher power into it. It would be a sane thought for me to realize that that's crazy. So, you know, I don't know, Mike, nothing's really kind of coming to me. I do these, it seems like most inventories I write are of fear. And it doesn't take long to find the same thing. You know, it's almost as soon as I sit down, it's kind of like walking into a sacred space. As soon as I walk in, it's like, okay, I feel the presence of God. It's as soon as I start writing this down that it just, okay, that's right. It's my old friend self-reliance. It's my old friend, I shouldn't have to ask for help, you know. I should be pretty competent. And I remember being in a meeting once in early recovery, and there was a guy, and this was a traditions meeting. It was this big Mac Daddy meeting, you know, where they're all old timers, like graduate AA, you know. And I used to go and I sit at the feet of the masters and learn about the traditions. And there was a guy who had apparently cancer, and I wasn't quite following the story, but apparently it was a legit thing. Now they'd set it up, and he's going to have this chemotherapy, and he's going to need some assistance, right? He waits till the end of the meeting. There's like he's the second to the last one to share. And he says this, that I'm going to need some help. And you can tell he just doesn't want to say. And he knows everybody in the room. Everybody knows, and they're all friends. And he waits till the end, and he says, you know, I might need some help cutting the grass. And, you know, I don't really want to have to ask. Maybe some meals. I might not be able to cook. And you can tell his buddies, I'm looking around, and they're like, what on earth is a man? I can't wait to, and they can't talk. You know, they're all like chomping at the bit to jump in and talk. And a newcomer shares, and he doesn't say anything about what this guy said, and you know, and you can tell these guys, they just jump up and they beeline to him, and they pretty much say, what is wrong with you? That's why we're here. I'm the only way I can get all the love, comfort, and understanding that my heart desires is by extending it to you. I can't really achieve this wonderful recovery and everything that it brings me without sharing it with you. It is my honor. Because if the tables were turned, would you, oh yeah, I'd show up, I'd cut your grass in a heart. But for me to ask you to come over and cook a meal for me is just, why is it so difficult to say please and thank you like that? And it's all grounded in fear that I need to justify my little square foot of space here. And I don't. I'm just completely justified just by being a child of God right here, right now. So I'll turn it over to you, Mike.
Yeah. Thanks. Well, I don't know exactly where this is going to fit in, but it's sort of inventory, so I'm going to fit it in here. And one of the great exercises I got from my friendship with Clint Hodges was my little post-it note in the morning deal, post-it note inventory. And what Clint suggests, he's, I just write down three to four, not more than five things you're not going to be willing to do today in order to have a better relationship with God. Okay. And then what? He says, nothing. Just put it in your pocket and take it with you. And as you're going through the day, take it out and see if you didn't make a decision to bring this into your life today. Whatever's going on. It's where, as Don told me in another context, I get to go scrape the shit happens bumper sticker off my car. Because shit doesn't happen, I draw it to me. And here's the deal. I periodically return to this. It's a great awareness exercise for me in terms of how self-reliance, no matter how well-intentioned, ends up taking me down the wrong path. So on this particular day here, I'm not willing to give up my perceived ability to predict the future. I can sit here and look at you, and I know what you're thinking. I know which one's going to bolt at lunch. I know which one's going to do, you know, this and that. Somebody's going to call the girlfriend. You know, all this. So, goes along with the next one, relates that I believe I can read minds. You know, I know what you're going to say. Really dangerous in an intimate relationship. You know, I tend to like preempt, answer my wife's question before she asked it. You know, unwilling to just be average. You know, I'll be the best you've ever seen or the worst you've ever seen, but just average. That seemed like, you know, and I insist on living a life full of distractions. And why is that a problem? Because as long as I'm distracted, I'm never really present with you or present with God. The guy that was my first sponsor, you remember Neil Sullivan? Did you know him before he passed? Anyway, Neil looked like Santa Claus. He was just a great guy and a very gentle guy. Probably a lot like Brother Mark there. And, you know, Neil asked me to take him to the airport one day, and I'm pretty new, and so I'm driving around the Beltway 465, taking Neil out to the airport, and some jerk in a blue Ford Escort cut me off. And, I mean, I'm on that son of a buck like whites on rice. I'm just, and I hear this giggling next to me in the seat, and Neil is just kind of trying to suppress a laugh and can't do it quite. He's giggling. And I go, what? He says, well, he says, you've had all these questions and doubts about being willing to turn your will and your life over to the care of God. He says, I just watched you turn your will and your life over to the guy in the blue Ford Escort. We just drove two exits past the airport. So that's, see, I get that stuff going in my life, don't even know it. So, you know, valuable exercise for me to, what is it today? What is it today that I'm not willing to do to have a closer relationship with God? And so that said, we're getting, I don't write much of any, I suppose I can't say I don't write any, but I write very little resentment inventory these days. As at least in my view, I write resentment inventory because I can't see where the fear is at. And the resentment inventory, it will help me expose the fear, and then I'm not done with the resentment inventory. I have to take the resentment into fear and look at it. And so here are a couple of examples. This one, Don had gotten double booked accidentally. This was back in 2000, and so I got tapped to fill in for him at this black tie event with a fancy dinner at a big hotel in Palm Springs. And, you know, there were all kinds of speakers, big name speakers that you would know their names on the program. And here I'm thrown into this. The pup throat gets thrown into being the banquet speaker. And about a week before I go out there, I go to a local speaker meeting, and a guy I really like gives a talk, and except I can't understand it. He gave a terrible talk. It sucked. And I'm driving home, and I'm going, what in the hell is wrong with him? You know, I mean, I've heard him, and I realize, wait a minute, this has got nothing to do with him. His talk was fine. I'm scared about mine, you know. So I wrote this little thing. This is called Palm Springs Trauma. So, I'm a dramatic. Dear Father, please give me the power to do your will and the strength and wisdom to do so with compassion. My first fear is I'm going to give a boring talk in Palm Springs. Why do I have it? Well, I'm full of pride, ego, and self-centeredness. I want to impress people rather than truly be of help and service. I want to show them how good I am rather than how great God and AA are. Better way, trust God. I must turn to God and give the talk that He wants me to give. Next fear rolling out there. I'm going to go blank and forget everything I know. Well, I've got that because I want to manage my life and I'm not trusting God. Answer, trust God. Let Him clear my mind of the clutter of self-serving thinking so I can speak the truth. Pretty much what I do today as a result of this is before I get into any spit, even sharing it at a meeting, I'll just internally give God, I can't not think about it, but I give God permission to reformat the hard drive here and just do what He wants to, and it seems to work out. I'm going to be the embarrassment to the people who recommended me, people in this case being Don, you know. I would not only want to manage my life, I want to manage the feelings of others, and I really want to do this for my comfort, not for theirs. So I'm still selfish here. Trust God. Remember why I'm doing this, to be a service. Well, I don't really belong with this in crowd, and I'm not who and what they think I am. Well, I'm mind reading. Once again, I'm more concerned with being what I fancy others think I should be rather than what God wants me to be. Trust God. The truth is, I've always received an abundance of love. Per St. Francis, I must seek to love rather than to be loved. If you've ever tried it, there's nothing more futile than standing at a podium trying to suck love out of a crowd of alcoholics. It's just... And, you know, you'd think after this I'd be happy if they canceled, you know. No. Next fear is I'm afraid they'll never ask me to do it again. Yeah. Ego never likes this stuff. I want to play God. I want to decide how I'm going to serve God. And my little dirty secret is I'd be willing to take the place of someone who could more effectively carry the message just to serve my own selfish ends. Trust God. Perhaps I can serve God even as a fool. In any case, it is for God to determine how I shall serve him. I only get to decide if I will be of service, not how I will be of service. And then finally, people will praise me out of kindness and pity. I got this because I'm acting out of self-interest rather than out of a sincere desire to serve God and others. And by the way, who the hell am I to judge the kindness of others and reject it? I mean, just who the hell do I think I am? Trust God. I will always suffer when I turn to sources other than God for my sense of self-worth and being. So on this, I did something else. This is not in the book, but occasionally helpful. I flipped the script on this, and look at this. What would I need to believe in order to make those fears rational? What would I need to believe about God? So, God's just waiting to get me. Okay, stick your neck out there, little boy. God doesn't care about my happiness, and God's just waiting to make a fool out of me. So, okay, there's some of the old ideas driving these fears that are popping up. Now, I get to ask myself the next question, is that what I really believe? Is that what my experience has really been? And part of it's some of the stuff we discussed already. What do I really believe? Well, God doesn't think comparatively. Fact is, God's never punished me. I've got consequences from decisions I've made, and I've certainly punished myself as I've gone along, but God never punished me. I'm a child of God, and He loves me absolutely and unconditionally. God won't make a fool out of me, but I can and will make a fool out of myself by trying to pretend to be what I'm not. And then God wants my happiness, not pleasure, even more than I do, and understanding the difference between happiness and pleasure. Pleasure is a pint of Häagen-Dazs, and there's a price to pay for that. But happiness, there's no downside to it. God will knows what will make my happy. So what I do is I start in with all these fears that this friend of mine gave a suck talk, and within a period of time it's all turned around. It's about me. We run through the fears, and I was able to go to Palm Springs, have a good time, and as a result, I've cleared up and got a little. I'm just a little one more half step closer to God as a result of doing all this. Anytime I clear out any of those old ideas. So, okay, here's a, yep, okay, so here's this one I call office drama. I had a partner in my business for 16 years, and Dave and I both occasionally a lot of the time saw things differently. And he would point out things like his name was before mine on the letterhead and on the door of the office and all this kind of stuff. Dear Father, please take away my fear and direct my attention to your solution. Dave's going to demand a change in our office sharing arrangement. Why do I have it? Well, I've let my business relationship with Dave just kind of drift along. I haven't been willing to force a definition of the relationship because I feared more responsibility either in terms of production targets or cash contributions. Vagueness seemed to suit my purpose. Trust God, humbly seek his help. I need to honestly look at Dave's side of things and remember that he has fears too. I need to be willing to be specific as to duties and responsibilities. I'm going to be harmed by an acrimonious business breakup. I've seen some of Dave's behavior towards previous partners, petty things like not forwarding the mails or phone calls. Trust God and humbly seek his help. I must strive to treat Dave fairly the way I want to be treated. I'm afraid of possible financial disputes arising out of years of unreconciled expenses. Well, my willingness for an accounting varied with whether I believed I was ahead or behind. I was willing to level up the books when I thought I was ahead, but when I thought I was behind, Again, vagueness seemed to suit my purpose. Trust God and participate in an honest and fair accounting with Dave. My income's going to be harmed. It appears no matter what the resolution may be that my expenses will increase and I will have to pay Dave, buy equipment of my own, or partner with somebody else and with whatever costs that entails. Trust God and humbly seek his help. My income doesn't need to be harmed in the long run, provided I'm willing to become more productive. Now we're getting down to it. I will be forced to change the way I do business. While I serve my clients well, I do it on my time, terms, and in my time. I spend virtually all my time on the care and nurturing of current clients and very little on prospecting. Trust God, humbly seek his help. I must be willing to embrace change in order to outgrow fear. So if I'm not willing to change, I'm guaranteed the fear is going to continue. And here we're getting to it. I don't know how to change the way I do business. I've never been in a business that required me to be successful at prospecting. I've never had any kind of mentor in this area. Dave's as lost as I am and can't teach me anything here. Trust God and humbly seek his help. I must acknowledge my shortcomings and be willing to ask for and accept help. I need a business sponsor. Who knew? And finally, of course, I will fail and be humiliated, which is like death, you know. I'm not trusting God. I'm trying to manage a relationship with another alcoholic. Dave and I got sober a week apart. Both of us suffer from the disease of extreme self-centeredness, and trying to manage it is insane. I must have God's help. Trust God and humbly seek his help. God loves me and wants my happiness. He allows me to fail so that I can learn, not as punishment. I'm as focused on God's agenda, not mine. And those things all worked out, but it's the fear inventory is, in my experience, a real helpful tool. So do you have anything more you want to share in that?
Yeah, I think something you said there about they have their fears too, and that seemed to come to an end of something. You know, it looks like I'm going to lose something or not get something that I need, and so the track I'm on seems to be coming to an end, and it's you know, it feels like a death, it feels like a loss, and I don't want to go that way. Everything's good. Let's just keep going this way, and it doesn't look like it looks like life is going to take a turn, and it's, I always think it's bad just because it ends. But the very first thing I did, you know, in sobriety was say that prayer. I came in here and I knew it was over. In fact, I knew Alcoholics Anonymous was not going to work. I knew that. Because I've been to your meetings and I read your book and it's just not going to work for me. It's just a matter of time before I drink again because that's the way it always was, right? You know, sure, I can put maybe 3 weeks together and then I'll just be minding my own business, driving down the street and pull into the liquor store. Just like that. It would happen just like that. And I know that's going to happen. And so a lot of these, you know, what happened is I said a prayer and my life changed. I used to drink every day for years. And then I said that prayer. I came into an AA meeting and I haven't had a drink every day for years. But I forget that. I forget that so easily. So when I come up against something that I don't want my life to go that way, I forget that there's often, you know, a pony and all that manure. There's a pony in there. I remember having I was going to get my truck repossessed in early recovery, and I needed like $220 or whatever it was, and I was talking to Rita, and I said I don't know what I'm going to do. They're going to come. I was like on day 60, you know. I kept like pushing it back, and you could only have 60 days, and they were going to come and get it the next day, and I didn't have the money. What am I going to do? I can't. She said, well, I don't know. What would you do if they took? No, they can't take my truck. I need to find like the $220, because we're not considering that we're not having that conversation. I don't know where I'm going to get the money. I mean, what? And I'm expecting her to say, well, you know, Bill's a banker or something. I don't know what I expected. And she said, well, what would you, what are you going to do if they take your truck tomorrow? And I'm like, but I can't, like, I won't even go there. And she finally was able to just make me concentrate and say, just pretend it's gone now. You walk out there and it's not there. What would you do? Just concentrate. What would you, just tell me what you do. It's not going to happen, but what would you do? And so I thought, well, what would I do? And then I realized, well, I have a bicycle, and I live in town. I work not too far from where I work. She said, you could ride the bus. I'm not going to ride the bus. You know, I don't know, I might walk, but. And so I'm thinking of kind of ordering my life, like, it wouldn't be the end. I mean, I could go to the ice house. I could go to meetings at the ice house, and it'd be inconvenient, but, I mean, I'd make do. I wouldn't like it for sure. I definitely wouldn't like it. I need that $220. But I realized that life was absolutely just fine. I was fine just like that. Now, I don't know what it, you know what, this was life-threatening at the time. I can't tell you how that got resolved. I don't know if I don't think I borrowed money from my parents. I don't know what happened, if they gave me a little extra time or got an advance of my paycheck. I don't know what it was, but the truck ended up not getting repossessed. But it didn't matter if it did. You know, the lesson that I got out of that, and I don't know that I got it right then, but I walked through so many things where it looked like, oh, I'm going to hit the wall. And then I didn't hit the wall. And it's like, oh, that's a trap door. That's cool. What's down here? And then you go, and then there's something that was like, oh, no. It's like one of those Romancing the Stone movies or Raiders of the Lost Ark or something, you know, where I remember a scene in one of those where, you know, he's at the edge of this big chasm, right? And he's got to go on the other side, and the little directions say, we have to stick your foot out there. And when you stick your foot out, then the bridge comes. So you have to make the commitment, right? I mean, you have to go all, you have to like go and make the step. And if there's no bridge, you're toast. You're just going to go down and splat. And that's what he does. And sure, and I'll tell you what, that has happened to me time and time. I got 1,000 stories about how I just put my foot forward, just saying, God, it looks like this is how you want me to go. I'm scared to death, but I know you're with me. And, you know, whatever happens, happens. And I'm not even, usually I'm not even thinking about the good stuff. Like, man, I bet this is going to be really cool. I'm scared, but this is going to be really cool. It's like, okay, this is it. I've lived a good life. It's all good. Thanks so much. And then it ends up, I'm just in a, you know, a garden at a tea party, and it's all lovely. And like that. So it's, you know, no fear. It's just a lot of times just hard work for me. It seems that if I just get past the fear, just get busy in the hard work, and I look up and it's just all just fine. I have my little basket of gifts, and just like you have your little basket of gifts and everybody else. And I think some of mine are cheesy. It's like if they knew I was an Elvis fan, they wouldn't like me, you know? But then when the time comes to play, Trivial Pursuit, it's like, ooh, the Elvis fan. She knows the answer to that, right? It's like we all intermesh with our own, I have my stuff, and people just say, oh, that's just Leslie doing her, you know, she's got to be a border collie and just let her do her stuff. And then there's, you know, the fun things that about me that, oh, yeah, I love that about her, you know. And we all have it. And so, you know, when I realized that everybody, we're all in the same mix here and bumping up against each other. And if I can just get in the slow lane, you know, I'll say this in hush, that I noticed how life slowed down dramatically. I felt like I was going like this through life the whole time. And then Rita just said, you know, it's robe and slippers time. Just kind of pulled me over and said, just do this. Go to a meeting every day. Go to work. And I'm like, okay, I'm doing this. I'm doing this. And it just seemed so slow. But it was just the right speed, you know. And I got to see so much doing that. So that's the only thought I have. Do you guys have questions about fear inventory? What do you all discover? What what's a cool insight somebody has had recently about looking at a fear and surmounting it? Or not. I just, if anybody had something that compelling that's like, yeah.
Hello, I'm Stephanie.
Hey, Stephanie.
There was some stuff going on at work, and I was absolutely terrified being in that situation. And I just wanted out, you know, I wanted out of, like, all the chaos that I was surrounded with, and, like, that was clouding my mind. Like, I let cloud my mind. And I ended up being let go. So it just, like, it turned out to be such a, like, a blessing. Like, and it's still scary sometimes, but, like, I'm so happy for, like, whatever is in store.
Yeah, thanks, Steph.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Recently I've been finding that all my fears basically boil down to I'm terrified of what people think of me, and I'm also afraid of being in any kind of emotional pain. So it's a fear of pain and fear of what people think of me, which is probably also related to fear of pain. And then there'll be a fear of being afraid, because that's uncomfortable too. But I think at the root of that is, I can't tell if it's selfishness spawns fear or fear causes the selfishness. But, like, at the root of it, it's, like, about how I feel. I'm thinking about me. And I think it says it's the root of all our trouble, selfishness, but I think it's the root of my fears, too. It's because I'm thinking about me. How do I feel? What do people think about me? I don't want to feel this way. I want to feel that way. I want this. I want that. That's kind of my insight into it recently.
Yeah, thanks, Reed. I know, you know what, I feel, I'm a tool, you know, on my very, very best day, I'm really just a tool of this higher power, you know, the higher power digs in and pulls me out, and I'm just this screwdriver, and I don't like being it, because it's not as interesting as, you know, some of the other tools, and I got this big, bright red handle, and I just, why couldn't I have a different color, and, you know, but I'm useful, right? And so God uses me, and then we're done with driving the screw, and then puts me down and, you know, picks Lindsay up. And then, you know, Lindsay is, maybe she's all happy about being a wrench, you know, but maybe she has her days where she doesn't want to be a wrench, and I'd rather be a red screwdriver. But I forget that when I'm all about myself, I'm not that useful, but when I'm just being a tool. I used to work in this restaurant where the same restaurant actually, and these busboys, they were giving each other grief, and one of them said, "Oh yeah, he's just a tool." And I thought, "Oh, that's so sweet." And they're looking at me like, "Man, she's old, she's clueless." But really, you know, if I'm just God use me and put me here, and then I see, wow, that was a cool interaction. Instead of, well, I don't know, I'm a little too fat, and my hair's getting gray. And when I'm thinking about all that, it's I'm not useful. I'm not there. I'm not present. Yeah, thanks, Reed.
Yeah. I'm Robert. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Robert.
Yeah, Robert. My question is for Mike. I guess it's on resentment and fear. You said a few minutes ago that God's never done anything to harm you.
Yeah.
And, how did you go through with your fiance, you know, suddenly having a stroke and not have any type of resentment or, I'm not saying, I mean, maybe you can explain it to it. You know, how did that, what was your part in that, is I guess what I'm asking. And then secondly is, now that you just got married again, do you not have any fear that something like that may happen again?
Sure.
I know that's you trying to replay God, yeah. But.
So the question was, how did I come to that place that God's never punished me or done anything to me, especially in light of Linda's death, and, you know, and how do I deal with that currently since I'm married again? So is that close to it? Yeah, okay. So the problem with, grief is a real legitimate and necessary piece of life. But the problem with people like me, and to my observation, most alcoholics, and what I tell the guys and that I work with is, okay, somebody important to you has died, or, you know, there's something that's happened in your life that you're gonna need to grieve over this, and don't avoid that. But be aware that we're the people that we skate right through grief into self-pity. And I'm not going to be able to keep that from happening, but I need to have a structure around me, people or a spiritual practice, that when I slide into that self-pity zone, that I understand this is no longer grief, this is self-pity. And self-pity for me in the Linda case is when I start making her dying about me, you know. The fact is, and I actually got, if you will, a visitation, a consciousness of her. One time I was sitting on a bench in the D terminal at Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, and I heard her voice, and she said, "Mike, you can grieve as much as you want to, but understand that I don't need your grief. It's for you, and I'm fine." And so that was, you know, that was one of the things that helped turn me in another direction in that, because I've been taught to, you know, it's my selfishness, self-centeredness, self-pity, all that stuff, self, one way or another, is my default setting. And there is no changing that. That's the way I'm built. And so how do I, knowing that, it's like going out to drive on a slick road in the winter where I live. You know, I know the conditions, what the conditions are, and I can get where I'm going safely, provided I drive to match the conditions. So as I go through my life, I understand I've got all these self-default settings. I can't change the conditions, but I can. How am I responding to them? What's my level of awareness? Is the fact that Linda died, is that my trump card that I get to play and say, you know, you can't talk to me about that because you don't know what it's like to lose something, you know. That's one of the crazy things I did that kept me drunk for a long time. See, it seemed like it worked. The job I had was mostly leading an infantry platoon in the Mekong Delta. And I spent a lot of time putting people I cared about into body bags. And I could tell you, and look you in the eye and say, well, yeah, there was this day in the Plain of Reeds where 29 of us went out, and 3 days later, there were 3 of us that came back from that. Now, don't you tell me about whatever, you know, and it seemed like it was working, but it was my way of keeping you at arm's length. People will send me various vets with combat issues to sponsor or talk to. I almost always disappoint them because, well, I can't. For me, I had to drop that piece of it before I could get to bed. I couldn't. You got a choice between living on as an active alcoholic or dropping the persona that I'm this damaged veteran, you know. Other people have had other experiences and so forth, but I couldn't hang on to that. So it's some awareness around that. Today, okay. Well, funny you asked. I called Jess before we started, and I didn't get an answer. Well, I thought, okay, she's probably in the shower. She's getting her home group meets at 11. So I didn't think much of it. When we went on break, I called her. I didn't get her. And, you know, there's just that little thing in the back of my head. What was the last time you kept calling and calling and no answer? And I called again 5 minutes later. I got an answer. But, yeah, there's you know, that'll whisper in my ear from time to time. But see, there's the selfishness. One of the things I had to look at with Linda when I did some writing about that was, hey, she was 14 years younger than I was. I planned on her taking care of me when I was old, all this kind of stuff. And my plan, I'll tell you, the real plan thing that I had to face was there was the time when we thought she was going to survive, and was I going to be able to show up and be willing to push her around in a wheelchair for the rest of the days? Did I have the integrity to live with that? And so forth. So I had to look at, because I felt a real stab of fear at that. Oh, what if that's my future? You know. And that's, like I said, I had to go, thank you for sharing. You know, one of the things Don told me that's proved true is that, you know, it's almost impossible to overestimate the self-centeredness of any alcoholic. It's probably theoretically possible, but as a practical matter, almost never happens. One of the great gifts he gave me was when we first got together in a program sort of way, I asked him if he would take me through the steps, and he said he would. He said, and he made me a curious promise. He didn't say that if you do this with me, by the way, he didn't like the expression of doing the work. He says, I don't relate to that at all. He says, writing inventories, making amends, and all that stuff, that is not the work of Alcoholics Anonymous. That is making you fit to do the work of Alcoholics Anonymous. The work of Alcoholics Anonymous is carrying this message to other alcoholics. That stuff you think is work is not work. It's preparation. And, you know, it's an important, because I get real, well, I've spent a lot of time working. No. Self-congratulatory. But he made me this strange, strange promise, or so I thought at the time. He said, Mike, he says, if you walk this path with me, I'll show you how to live in the presence of death without fear, including your own. But that's, I thought, well, that's just Don Dean Zen, you know, and so forth. And it's turned out to be a promise that's been realized. I've been in the presence of death a lot of times since that, and I've been able to be useful. One of the best things about it, if you want to call a best thing around Linda's death and some other deaths that I've been associated with, is I wasn't part of the problem. Nobody had to be around worrying about what are we going to do about Mike. I remember my father died, when he, the last time I went to the hospital, I was still, of course, drinking at the time. I was pretty well together. I was doing well. I still had one of those nice cars in the garage, but I had to keep going back out to the garage to get a drink every now and then in order to be in that hospital room with him. And I remember the last time I actually touched my dad was my dad asked me to, he didn't want to use the bedpan. He wanted me to help him get up and get into the bathroom in that hospital room. And so I'm helping him out of bed and standing him up, and he was a big guy. And even though he was shrunken down a bit, and I'm holding him there, and I can still feel, I felt his body stiffen under me when he smelled the liquor, and he just turned his head like that. And he didn't need to say a thing. I knew I'd broken his heart. So I don't have to show up that way again. And so, that's kind of the deal there. one of the things I was had a question when we started out here about that inventory we began with last night about the college girlfriend and so forth. And I was, see if I can find it here. Somewhere. Got too much stuff. All right. So I'm sitting, I'm a cancer patient, by the way, these days. I have metastatic cancer, and they tell me there's not an exceptionally bright future with that, but I'm enjoying life. But I'm sitting in my oncologist's waiting room, this was back toward the end of February this year, and my phone chirps, and I look down, and it's an email from my brother that he's the good brother, you know, the one that always does the right thing. He's on Ancestry.com trying to find some family history to help out some other family members. And he says, I got this, he got an email and he asked his permission to send. Anyway, here's what the email popped up. Hello, Mike. Your brother, Robert Lorenz, gave me your email address and said that you might be able to assist me. I'm fairly new to Ancestry.com and new to the search for my biological family. Ancestry matched Robert and I as having a close family DNA relationship. So far, this is the only close DNA match for me. And then it goes on, our analysis of your DNA predicts that the person you match with is closely related to you. For example, your uncle or grandfather. I'm a 47-year-old woman. My parents adopted me from Catholic Charities out of Sacramento, California. I was born in February of 1971. I have a family tree started, but it's all from my wonderful adoptive family. I'm curious to learn more about my biological family tree, and I would appreciate any information or help you might have to give me. I would also like to say that I have had a good life and a loving adoptive family. I am happily married and have one amazing 13-year-old daughter. I'm grateful to my biological parents for making what I'm sure was not an easy choice and ensuring that I had a good life. I'm curious about my biological roots and any available relevant medical history. I'd like to be able to provide that information to my daughter for her benefit. I want to be sensitive to the fact that the story of my birth might not be known or shared, and I do not want to cause my biological parents and their families any distress. Thank you again for your assistance. Best regards, Joey, and then the last name. There we are, right there in the waiting room. And by the way, I walked in, had that appointment with the oncologist, and the oncologist said, Mr. Lorenz, currently, it won't be permanent, but currently your cancer is at undetectable levels. Other interesting thing, that was Wednesday. On Friday morning, I got on a plane and flew to Sacramento, California to do a workshop that had been scheduled a year and a half in advance up for some people up by Lake Tahoe. And it turns out that was about 15 miles from where Joey lives today. Now, she was off on spring break with her daughter at the time, so I didn't get to do face-to-face with her. But we've since been in a lot of contact. And the end of next month, I'll be going out to Sacramento and that little town up the road toward Tahoe to spend some time with my daughter and granddaughter. We since had the DNA match confirmed and so forth. And she's, well, you can maybe tell by the email, she's got a lot more of her mom in her than I do, and than me, because she was sensitive to the fact that she might be upsetting other people's lives. And it wasn't all about her. And by the way, she wasn't bitter. She wanted me to write, no, at the top, she's happy and she's had a great life. And I got to look at, I've got, it's still unpacking it, but, you know, we're talking on the phone and a while back, and Joy said, oh, you know, I'm so glad we connected, and da da da. And she's, I'm just, she's, I think the only regret I have is it took 47 years for it to happen. And I, God said it for me. I didn't have a thought. I just blurted out, I said, Joey, it took God 47 years to make me worth connecting with. You know, here's the deal. See, I felt so injured and abused and everything else but what happened. If Ellen had stayed with me and we'd had that baby and everything had gone even the way I thought it should go at the time, that girl would have been raised in raging, terrible alcoholism for at least the first 14 years of her life. Can I look at myself in the mirror and say that I would have wanted that for any daughter of mine? And so we're going along, and here's the other thing. After Joey and I connect and so forth, of course, the question is, well, who's my mom? You know? Do you know who my mom is? And I said, yeah, I know who your mom is. And, well, I'd honored her when she came back after having the baby. As I may have mentioned last night, she just since wouldn't tell me boy, girl, anything, and just said, stay out of my life. And I did, and I have, and I didn't. Of course, she was on the amends list, but that was one where it would cause harm to make the amends. So I knew from her parents' obituaries and stuff like that, that I knew what her married name was and where she, what town she lived in at least, and so forth. So I said, well, Joey, I think maybe I can locate her, but I'm going to have to ask her permission before I do this. I'm going to, I'll tell you what I'm willing to do is I'll write her a letter and we'll leave her the option of whether she wants to connect up or not. Let that be her choice. And she said, of course. And so I wrote a letter and I sent it to Joey and I said, will this work for you? And she said, yes, but I'd like you to make one change. I'd like you to put a sentence in there that says, if she chooses not to connect, I will understand, but please to let us know that she's received this letter so I don't continue wondering and searching and so forth. So that's what we did. So here's the letter that was sent March 28th of this year. Dear Ellen, please forgive my intrusion after all these years. Last week, I received the following email, what I just read you here. Since receiving this email, I've been in contact with Joey via email, text, and an extended phone conversation. The details she's given me, including photos and her DNA match to my brother Bob as her uncle, have convinced me that she is almost certainly the child you placed for adoption. She's an amazing woman who is especially grateful that you provided her with a chance to grow and thrive with her adoptive family. Connecting with her is a blessing, a piece of grace that I never expected to receive. In our conversation, I made it clear to Joey that it was your courage and principles that made her life possible. I told her that I treated you horribly, without equivocation. My treatment of you is the most shameful thing that I've done in my life, and whatever you may decide to say to her won't be too harsh. Joey knows only that your name is Ellen. Should you choose, here are the ways you can contact her. And then Joey understands and will respect your decision if you decide not to connect, but asks that you let one of us know so that she won't continue in limbo. If this has awakened memories and feelings about the harm I did to you and your family that you'd like to discuss, you can reach me in the following ways. I pray that you are enjoying a wonderful life. And about 10 days after I sent that, I'm driving down the road from Indianapolis to Louisville to see Jess, and my phone lights up, and it's Ellen. And she wasn't in my contact, so I had no idea. So it was a surprise. We talked, and it was both a disturbing and a beautiful conversation. Disturbing because it's one of those things where you hear some pieces of truth about yourself that you just didn't want to hear, you know. She said, you know, she says, you must, she said, first of all, she says, I'm surprised you're alive. I thought you must have been dead a long time ago. And then she said, I recognize the lingo, she called it the lingo in your letter, that you must be in AA. put together lingo and the fact I'm still alive. And she went on, she says, here's what you don't know that happened. She had three brothers, and she was one of three girls. She said, all three of my brothers have died of alcoholism. And my oldest son, my only son, is sober 8 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I occasionally go to open meetings with him, so I recognize the language. And she and I talked, and she almost ended up making a she says, Mike, I've always felt terribly about depriving you of a relationship with your daughter. She said, but you were, I'm trying to get the exact word, you were so mercurial and occasionally violent in your mood swings that I didn't know how I could protect myself from you, and I certainly knew I couldn't protect her from you, and so I had to give her away. And that's who I was. That's who I was. And, you know, years had softened, taken the edges off that memory. That, yeah, I'd been kind of a jerk at times, and yeah, I'd been a little this and that and the other thing. But I thought, you know, mercurial and violent, that's a little excessive. You know, not really, you know. And here's the proof. You know, the funny thing is she got shed of me. She's been married to her husband for 42 years, so apparently she wasn't the problem. she's able to have a stable relationship. So, you know, we just don't know what the unfoldment of these things are. And it takes years and years and years and sometimes for these things to unfold. I never had any expectation. I have, we'll talk maybe later, but I had a couple of stepdaughters in my life at one time. I've always wondered about that child, and I've always had a sense she was a girl, and I always hoped she was a girl. In that one of those, I always just wanted a girl. It turns out I get a bouncing 47-year-old baby girl, you know, complete with the. We're wondering about the granddaughter. Frances just completed a full-on campaign, which she won for president of her freshman high school class. So she may have some of Grandpa in her after all, but we're not sure. So we're getting close here. I want to mention one more thing here about we kind of covered the sex conduct piece of that inventory last night, so I won't be redundant there. But I found, and the men I work with have found, the questions available in that inventory are very useful in a lot of other situations where we've tried other approaches to inventory and they haven't really produced satisfying results. Here's one from my own experience. My mother suffered from dementia / Alzheimer's from 9 years before she passed away. And I was the oldest, and I really hated losing that relationship with her. I have two brothers that still do live in the old hometown, so they were the ones that primarily had the primary responsibility for Mom, and then I have a sister in St. Louis. And I kind of had to come up with how I felt about this and what my behavior was. And here's the inventory I wrote. Fathers, please set aside my prejudice so I can see the truth. Mother, I've selfishly avoided my mother as her Alzheimer's has progressed. I've called infrequently and done minimal visiting. I've dishonestly assumed that her condition prevents her from realizing what my behavior is and that I can just show up from time to time and she won't know the difference. I've inconsiderately let my brothers and sister do most of the heavy lifting. I've only done what I've been specifically asked to do and given support to others. I haven't gone the extra mile. I've emotionally abandoned Mom for my own comfort and in order to avoid the feelings of powerlessness, grief, and fear that come with her illness. I mentally deal with her as she was, not as she is. When I allow myself to reflect on my behavior, it's as if I've buried her alive. I need to honestly face my emotions about her conditions. I must stop playing God. She's alive, and I must maintain a relationship as if she's fully cognizant, because she may be from time to time, and I won't know which times those will be. And that allowed me to reset that whole thing. And not only treat my mom appropriately, but the family came out closer at the end of it. That's one of those things that can either break you up and divide you or closer. And so I've got the other siblings are functional people. So where I came to look at this is that that disease, as terrible as it was, in some respect, was really her last act of parenting. Because all of us kids, we all liked each other, but we all had separate lives and weren't particularly connected, and we'd get together for the occasional holiday or something and everything else. Because of what we needed to do with Mom, we all drew closer into more active relationships. And then Mom, it turns out, became one of my spiritual teachers when I realized, she got fantastic treatment because she was in a small town in the Midwest. She was able to not have, you know, institutional style care. She was able to be in a family-owned facility with people who were, the people at the care facility she was in let her believe she was a volunteer there. So she'd be out. I'd go in. She'd be in the dining room rolling up silverware and napkins and straightening up tables. And you know, these people need the help, you know, and so forth. When she was going into this, and when she'd have loss of memory and then come back to the present world and all this kind of stuff, was very terrifying for her. When it fully had her, I realized it, she was very happy. And the reason she was happy is she lived completely in the present.
I'm so sorry.
Oh no, it's no.
Turning it off, and now
it's not. It's not a problem. Had that happened before.
There we go.
The classic example. We were sitting with Byrne, Bob. We were sitting with one of my sponsees in a meeting, and he was pontificating a bit, you know. And Siri came on, and Siri says, Bob, I don't know what you're saying. we all had a great one. So anyway, what had happened was Mom lived, once the disease had her, she was living completely in the present. She was happy. And they loved having her there. And when they had to go out and run errands, they put her in the van and take her along and buy her a Baskin and Robbins ice cream cone along the way, because she was just kind of like a favorite in that place. And when she finally died, she sat down at dinner in that dining room, and they brought the entree, and she had her entree. And when they took away the plate and came back with the dessert, she just put her head down on her arm and had gone away, had left. See, I used to say my mother suffered from Alzheimer's. The fact was, I suffered from it. She didn't. And getting that clear, and that inventory piece being the start of it. So these questions and these inventory principles are available for a lot of different use for all of us. So it's about time to go get ready for lunch, and we'll have a great afternoon. Thank you.